Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear radio program. I am your host, Susan Laris and Dance, and I'm once again talking to you from another absolutely beautiful day in the Pacific Northwest. We have had one of the most beautiful falls that I can recall on record where it's actually sunny, and that's kind of unusual for this part of the country at this time of year. Today, I am once again welcoming back, after it's been almost a year, one of my good friends and a mentor who has had a real impact on the lives, not only of myself, but on many, many creative people. And his name is Mark David Gerson. Mark David is involved in so many inspirational activities that it's almost difficult to express them all in an intro. He is a very talented, award-winning author. He's a screenwriter. He is involved in making a trilogy of visionary fantasy films based on his fantasy novel, The Moon Quest, which had won a number of awards. He is a very prolific writer and has been writing the sequels to The Moon Quest very quickly. And Mark David is also a teacher who has coached people in the realm of creativity and spirituality for over 20 years. And in fact, that's how I first came across Mark David, is he was actually my coach. He came along very early on for me when I was still an online writer. For many years, I wrote anonymously, and some of my writing was surfaced fairly high, all the way to the front page of the Oprah website, but it was always anonymous. And through Mark David's help, he helped me to own my authentic voice. And I'll be chatting with him today because I have something going on in my life in the realm of speaking now, which is so very similar. So we may even do some spontaneous coaching just to demonstrate what Mark David does, because he and I are going to have a very authentic discussion today. Now, if you would like to call into today's show, and we do welcome callers, if someone would like to call in and ask a question of Mark David, that call-in number is 310-807-5104. There is also an open chat room. Both Mark David and I are in the chat, and we will respond to questions and comments in the chat on the show itself. I'm sure I know it can get a little distracting to type in the chat and talk, and so some of the responses may be in the chat itself, and some may actually be on the show. So without further delay, I would like to welcome my friend and mentor, Mark David Gerson. Welcome, Mark David.
Hi, Susan. It's great to be back.
You know, I realized in doing the intro, I also failed to mention the voice of the muse answering the call to write. I've got such a list. But, you know, I think that's a fascinating thing because I know right now, or at least in recent months, and you can fill me in on this, your focus has really been on the Quintana trilogy. It's just, you know, it's amazing the many things you have done. But I do want to mention that book, The Voice of the Muse, is rising every day in popularity. I see your updates on how it's you know, its rankings are going up on in automated form and all that. And I know that it really has inspired a lot of writers, including me. And you have meditations associated with that book. So again, that your let's just say your introduction overfloweth. Because it just goes on.
I know, it's a little overwhelming for me some days.
So how are you doing, Mark David? Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on with your current projects and
sure.
relate that to how, you know, others who are listening. I know today we're going to have an authentic talk about how even those who are way showers, I feel like, you know, I run into this. I even get people writing to me saying sometimes they almost feel hypocritical because they're facing blockages or fear and, you know, they're trying to teach. And boy, I like to say we are all on a journey. And that's what I always
Yeah, we're
say.
All... We're all in the same boat. Maybe we may have different positions on the ship, but we're all in the same boat. You know, it's funny. Well, I'm going to back up and mention The Voice, The Muse, because you're right. My focus really has been on The Moon Quest and its sequels, which form the Quintana trilogy of books and feature films. And in fact, we had a meeting yesterday. I'm also an associate producer on the project. We had a kind of a producers meeting yesterday. Just talking about some marketing potential in terms of attracting financing and such. And one of the things that occurred to me, because, you know, we're talking about marketing and merchandising and you know, and the things that help make money for movies, that Moon Quest is all about storytelling, which, of course, is linked to writing, certainly. And I thought, well, how interesting would it be if the Moon Quest, which was kind of, in terms of sales and prominence, second cousin to The Voice, The Muse for so long, if it switched, and if, in fact, The Voice, The Muse became a sort of Moon Quest workbook. Because, again,
yes.
It's all about helping you find your voice and your storytelling voice. But so that's a kind of amusing aside. But going back to what you were saying a moment ago about, you know, the way showers and their issues, Two years ago, I guess, I was pushed, prodded, poked to begin a memoir, and I was incredibly resistant. And you and I may have talked about that at the time. I don't remember.
Oh, yes, we did.
And I did begin it. And then, as sometimes happens, the life that ends up going into a memoir got in the way of writing the memoir. And I was off it for a while, did some more work on it last year, and then the Moon Quest sequels and the Moon Quest movies took my time. And when I finished the Sun Quest, the first draft of the Sun Quest, which is the third and final installment in the Quintana trilogy, it was very clear from my muse, who's no longer the gentle creature portrayed on The Voice News cover, but she's kind of Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS. She's no longer holding a quill, she's holding a whip.
Anyhow, oh, dear.
It was, you know, get back to the memoir, which I have been working on since just before the beginning of the month. And this, you know, for someone who has now written either completed books or drafts of four books and three screenplays, this memoir, to my incredible surprise, is the hardest thing probably since the Moon Quest that I've had to write. And so, yeah, I'm going through my own stuff around this right now, as are you, and of course as are others, because, you know, you talked about authentic voice and authentic living. Well, it's a moving target. It's not like, wow, I've got my authentic voice today on Friday, December 9th, and now I have it forever, because the stakes keep getting pushed to go deeper within ourselves and speak or write that depth as we discover it. And so that's kind of been a challenge for me in watching my life flash before me on the page as I write this memoir, and kind of being forced to relive things that aren't necessarily traumatic, but they're certainly emotionally intense.
Yeah. Well, I've been running away from my own memoir for a long time. I mean, there are things in my life. Mark David knows things about me that it would be a heck of a memoir, wouldn't it? if I can ever really write my story. He's not allowed to reveal those things.
but I have had a journey. Well, you know, the kidder in me will say, you know, no time like the present, but you know, of course, that when the moment comes, when it's time, there will be no escape.
I have found that.
You will simply have to do it.
Things kind of come out a little at a time. And, you know, when we, I think probably the hardest part about writing about your own life is that, number one, you're still living it. And also, you know, it does have some impact on the people around you. And so that, to me, is probably the most challenging in terms of being, you know, utterly honest. And that doesn't mean that, you know, what I would choose to write would be some scathing thing. That's not it at all. It's a challenging thing, you know, when you want to be sensitive to certain things. And, you know, in some ways for me, even speaking openly like I have about leaving evangelical Christianity, I mean, that's taken a lot of courage because, you know, there are people in my life who that would really hurt, you know, and they know it to some degree or another. But and you do kind of think about that. And so somewhere there's a balance, but it doesn't cause me to stop talking about that.
So the balance comes up not in writing a first or second draft. The balance comes up down the road from that when you have to decide what is going to, or discern, never mind decide, but you have to discern and intuit what will make the final cut in the final draft. And, you know, this is an issue for me, too. Now, my background isn't as sensational as yours.
You know, people don't realize, you know, you're saying that. It's like they're going to start wondering what the heck has happened to
Susan. I'm building an audience here.
And, you know, they think I have such a gentle voice, you know, and that I probably haven't had anything. You know, I think you could make a movie out of my life, potentially. I mean, that's how dramatic some of what has occurred to me has been.
So,
it's like I'm giving teasers for this memoir that doesn't exist.
I know. So
now
you're going to have to write it, of course, because you're teasing everybody. But and we may have even talked about this. I certainly talk about it because I have taught a memoir writing workshop. You have to write what you have to write in that first draft. No holds barred. No punches pulled. Names, everything. Then, because you've got to get it out of your system. Then, because your first draft, alas, is never your last draft, or never your final draft, rather. And then, as you go back through it, having released the emotional charge from yourself by putting it on the page, then you're in a better position to discern what really needs to be there, what really needs to be there to tell your story. And then you have to decide, discern into it, you know, who the casualties may be and what repercussions are you prepared to live with.
Yeah.
But that isn't a decision for the outset.
Yeah.
You know that, I mean, one of the challenges for me in writing the movie, not the Boom Quest, it was a similar issue, the memoir, which is called Acts of Surrender, is that until a few days ago, so until after I'd gotten past 55,000 rambling first draft words, until that point, I had no idea what the shape of this was.
Yeah.
I don't have a really clear idea now, but I have more of an idea now. I can sort of begin to see a shape. It took me 55,000 words to get there.
Wow.
How many of those 55,000 words will be in the final draft? I don't know. I'd like to think most of them just because I don't want to have to do it 20 more times, but I don't know. So I had a client, a coaching client, who'd already written an award nominated memoir. She came to me to work on a novel that she was stuck on, but she said that the memoir that she began to write was not the memoir that she ended up with.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's very, very common, really.
Yes, and for me that happens. You know, I mean, when I began the Moon Quest, as you know, I was clueless, as I was most of the way through it. I didn't have an outline for a story. I didn't have a story idea. I had an opening scene that was actually sparked by a tarot card in a class I was teaching. And I just kept writing blind. Now, when you write a memoir, you assume you're not writing blind because it's your story, so shouldn't you know it? But one of my, I love rules for writing and living that always start with there are no rules. One of my rules for memoir writing is you may own your story, you don't own the book.
Yeah.
In other words, it's up to the book to decide the shape. And so,
I love that. Your book actually exists, right? I mean, I remember us talking about that you can actually talk to your book because it exists over time.
That's right. And so with a memoir, it's almost more frustrating because you come in with the assumption that you ought to know how it goes because it's your story, you've lived it, you know it intimately. But you know the facts and you know the emotions, you don't know the shape.
Yeah.
And the shape is what reveals itself over time through the writing of it. And for me, I won't say that I forgot that particular rule, but I guess I felt, having written as much as I had, I had earned the right to know more than I did. and apparently I hadn't. So, that's just that was just the way it went. And what's also interesting, and this may come up for you too, because I know that some of the things that are in your book you haven't spoken about publicly before, but some you have. And many of the things that I'm writing in Acts of Surrender, I have written about, I've mentioned on my blog, I've talked to about in classes and coaching sessions. And so I thought the charge would be gone. But guess what? Writing it in this form, the charge isn't gone. The charge is as potent as it was first time around. And sometimes I finish a segment and it leaves me gasping for air because I just, I can't believe that I'm still carrying that charge all these years later.
Yes.
Having spoken about it so objectively to so many people or written about it in my blog for so often. But, the story is what the story is, and the charge reminds me of how important it is for me, never mind for anyone who might want to read it, which is a whole other issue I have around this memoir, but how important it is for me. And it's interesting because when I wrote The Sun Quest, which I wrote the first draft in what was for me a record 21 days, I don't know that I could ever do that one again, but I wrote 62,000 words of The Sun Quest in 21 days. In the prologue of The Sun Quest, which is told by its main character, just as the prologue of The Moon Quest is told by Toshar, its main character, he is saying, basically, that he only discovered why certain things happened to the writing of them. And I think that is so incredibly true. In my blog, of course, when I talk about personal experiences, I'm doing it from a teaching perspective, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using my life as an example to make a point. When it came time to write, to begin the memoir, the guidance from the muse or from the book or from whoever is in charge to curate me was none of that. You write the stories and your experience of the stories and you leave the interpretation to the readers. And for me that was very difficult. And I realized the reason why is because on my blog I have control.
Mm-hmm.
I can present my stories in a way that I control how you respond to them because they're in the context of a point I'm trying to make. In the book, they're just there.
Yeah.
And I'm naked with no control to cover me up.
Yeah.
And I think that in the memoir was or has been or is still the most challenging experience I'm having.
You know, to hear you talk about the exercise of writing a memoir, it almost feels like it would be there's some need, it seems, or I don't know about if need may be too strong of a word, but the very act of writing a memoir, even if you will never publish it, even if you have no idea, even if you don't think of yourself as a writer, just sitting down and writing your life story is a spiritual exercise in itself. In fact, it not only reveals some hidden lessons I have found when I've written about my own experiences, and I have written about them privately. Sometimes I've blogged, but, you know, it's funny, my blog's been kind of quiet, and I'll talk about that in a little bit maybe. But I have found that you actually remember more, too, and it's not a selective memory either. As you write about it, you remember, and there are things we all forget about our own past. And so there is a very real exercise here, and I'm sure there are people doing this. Probably, you know, it's really a form of therapy, too, to just explore who you are or where you came from, because who you are now is what matters most. But
of course.
It actually, when we explore the things that we've triumphed over, and I know both of us have had experiences where, you know, we've had to overcome challenges, and we're still facing challenges of one kind or another. And, you know, I think if anything that can be conveyed right now is that, and I get so much feedback from people on this, is how many people are facing challenges right now. And some of these people firmly believe in the law of attraction, and they say, you know, what is wrong with my intent? You know, and I know people who have the purest of faith. In fact, you are one of those people who I feel is very focused on where you're heading, and yet it just doesn't always happen in the way that you expect. And I think we have to leave those possibilities open and also realize that the context of the world overall is influencing us right now. If, for example, the financial system is shifting in a very big way, maybe having tons and tons and tons of money right now isn't necessarily where you want to be, because
yeah.
It could be gone in an instant. And so I'm not saying that you shouldn't have abundance to support yourself. I mean, it's important to, and there are many people, it's very common to be facing challenges with that too. But I feel the world is shifting, and it influences us.
No, that's absolutely true. And going back to what you said before about remembering things as you wrote, before I returned to writing on Acts of Surrender, I reread what I had written over the past 2 years, off and on. And I was startled by what was there, because it was stuff that apparently I remembered while I was writing it, but I didn't even remember now, a year later.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, it happened years back. I remembered it as I was writing it last year, and now it's like, oh, my God, I didn't remember that. How did I know that? So, yeah,
uh-huh.
I mean, it really is interesting. When we get into that zone, whatever needs to emerge, emerges, and maybe it stays with us, and maybe it just stays on the page. In my case, a lot of it just stayed on the page.
Yeah.
And I was surprised to reread it. And, you know, as for what you were talking about afterward, it's really important, and this is, you know, I have some issues with the law of attraction people and the secret people,
mm-hmm.
the secret
well,
people.
And
you and I have talked too.
Yeah.
We've talked about that before. Because how it's often presented, which isn't really how it truly is, I believe, but how it's often presented is, you know, it's direct cause and effect. You say what you want, you attract it, and there it is. However, I know from my life experience, and I know that you know from yours as well, that often what we think we want is not our true desire.
Yeah.
Our true desire is hidden, coming back to the theme of the show, is hidden underneath, you know, layers and layers and layers and more layers still of fear and terror and all the things that we set up to protect ourselves from what parts of us believe are dangerous. If I went after only what I thought I wanted, first of all, we wouldn't be having this telephone conversation, or this radio conversation, because I wouldn't be a writer. I did not want to be a writer. I wanted to not be a writer, as a matter of fact. It was nowhere in my conscious desiring, although apparently it was having a very thriving life, my unconscious desiring under the surface. I had no desire. I'm Canadian. I had no desire to move to the U.S. and live here. And here I have now been here since 1997. And with no conscious plan or intention to go back. So, and I, you know, I'd never wanted to necessarily be an artist. I've sold my art to no one's greater surprise than me. So I think that the problem when we say, I want this and this is what I need to do to get it, and there's nothing wrong with that up to a point, is that all we're doing is touching the tip of the iceberg in that very tired cliche, but the full depth and breadth and magic and scope of what we truly desire in our hearts, in our souls, is hidden beneath the surface of the water. And if all we're focusing on is that little pokey thing poking out of the water on the iceberg, we're missing most of life.
Yes. You know, for me, I think I'm beginning to come to a realization about reality that is really a merger of everything I've been taught. You know, when I was young, all I heard about in church was God's will. And that was, of course, external to you. And it was this great plan that you were in. And you really didn't have a lot of control, although you could pray for things. And then, you know, there's the other way of looking at it that I then was exposed to through New Age circles. And actually back then it really was called New Age, although I'm starting to use that term more because I think a New Age is dawning. But the whole concept behind the law of attraction, which often was misrepresented as immediate gratification, as if you have a genie sitting right in front of you and I want this now. You know, I want a new car and here it comes. And, you know, it's not that you can't influence what happens to you because God is omnipresent. And, you know, one of the things I've been doing more and more, which is ironic, this is the thing I hinted at earlier in the show, is I have become an anonymous voice on the radio now, which is just hilarious. Not on this show, but on major mainstream radio. And on this show, sometimes there's 40,000 podcast downloads, and that actually beats Oprah. Oprah, the most I ever saw anonymously writing there, even on her front page, was about 25,000, maybe. And so I can't get over this. It's hilarious, but I'm running into similar issues where I'm talking very honestly about things on the radio as just Susan, and Susan in Portland, and it's a podcast, too. And one of the things I'm discussing is this concept of the omnipresence of God, because the audience for this show, which is on a station, which at every news hour, there's Fox News, it's filled with people who are evangelicals, but there are also other listeners. And I'm starting to map things so that they'll understand it. Like, when you as a New Ager, I can't even say this anymore where you say, I am God. I've had people force me to say that. You know, it comes across wrong to an evangelical audience because it makes it sound like some kind of challenge to God. And yet, of course, you're just what you were destined to be. So anyway, the thing about gratification and the plan and all that and what you're kind of expressing is that there is an aspect of this where at this level of human experience, we don't consciously know our greatest good. That
absolutely.
And so there is a plan. But the interesting thing is it's not some external plan being imposed on you. It is, you know, you are a full participant at the highest of levels in that plan, and you can shift it. I mean, you can influence what's going on, but not like a genie in a bottle quite. Sometimes the genie in the bottle thing does work, and people have seen it. I know I've had it happen at times where you ask for something, and there it is. You know, that's happened to me several times, actually.
Well, and usually when you ask for something and there it is, it's something that you don't have a huge emotional stake in.
Uh-huh.
Because you don't have all this drama around it. It's all the drama that usually holds us back from that, you know, from manifesting quite that easily. But no, absolutely, we have to assume that this physical Mark David Gerson who's sitting here talking to you right now is all the Mark David Gerson there is, to me is wrong. I mean, I have seen and experienced too much that cannot be explained to assume that. So when I say that, you know, my muse is coming at me with a whip, well, of course, my muse is me. And it's an aspect of me that says, get the damn book written.
Yeah.
Stop, you know, and as a character in the Moon Quest says, stop dilly-dallying, just do it.
Yeah,
and
actually, my
muse is saying the other part of me says, but I'm terrified.
Yeah.
And the first part of me says, well, do it anyway.
Yes. I think there does come a point, and I did just put this out to writers on Twitter, see if we've got any writers listening. And I know we'll get people listening in the archive later as well. But I think there is a balance with writing. I tend to cut myself slack, and probably almost too much, in terms of not necessarily having the discipline that I would have liked in the last year. I think that things do happen in perfect timing. And I think your life has probably shown that too. And it requires faith to trust that. And yet, there does come a time when you really feel, okay, I can't put this off anymore. It's time to write the book and
right.
finish
so
the book.
Right. So let me interrupt for a second because I want to come back on the word discipline, which I talk about a little bit in The Voice of the Muse.
Yes.
Because discipline reminds me of Old Testament God. You know, who will smite you if you don't do it. or the teacher who will wrap your, you know, the teacher, the old style teacher who will wrap your knuckles with a ruler. The discipline we've been taught is the kind of action that makes us feel guilty if we don't do it. It's the
right.
kind of action that we take because we're afraid of being punished at some level, you know, physical, emotional, spiritual, religious, if we don't do it. And that kind of discipline, you'll pardon my language, is bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Because anything in our lives that arises from that place of fear of consequence is unhealthy and codependent and needs to go away. Now, having said that, so that's what I call a hard discipline.
Yeah.
The discipline where and many, many, perhaps even the majority of writers and writing coaches and writing instructors say you park your butt on the seat and you do it. and I just, in fact, I just did a blog interview, and I'm actually going to read you what I wrote because in response
yeah.
to a question like that, I think I can pull it up pretty quickly. But while I'm pulling it up, what I look for is soft, what I call soft discipline. When I look at discipline, not, you know, as in bondage and discipline, but I look at discipline as in from the word disciple, where now I am not bound to my work, I am a disciple to my work, which is still a part of me, a disciple to my muse, which is still a part of me. And from that place, I do it from the passion trusting that the timing is correct, and do my now. You know, I'm trying to sound like this amazing paragon, and believe me, I'm not. I've got guilt, I've got fear, I've got all that stuff that, you know, I wish I didn't have. But this is what I aim for, and there are days when I do achieve it. Here's what I wrote. The question was, what is your work schedule like when you're writing? And I replied, for the most part, I don't believe in fixed routines. Rather, I operate intuitively in my writing and in my life. I'm not one of those people who writes at the same time every day or believes that you should sit down to write regardless of how you feel. While other coaches and instructors recommend applying a regular routine to create a production, that method never works for me for very long. Rather, I remain as in the moment as I can and follow wherever the inspiration leads me, in my life as well as in my writing. That way of living and writing is both exhilarating and at times terrifying, but it does keep things in an organic balance. And so operating from an inner discipline, an inner discipleship, and trusting in the kind of perfect timing you spoke about a few moments ago, doesn't mean I don't beat myself up, although I certainly do it way less than I used to. It doesn't mean that I don't fear or have doubts, although I have fewer than I used to. It does mean that if I feel this is what needs to be done, I do it, which is how I got 62,000 words written in 21 days, because I couldn't, perhaps for the first time in my writing life, I couldn't not do it.
Yes, and that's very important. That's an important distinction, and I know I'm beginning to get a feel for what that feels like. You are so right about not allowing guilt to motivate us. You know, even in actions, if you're doing something kind, for example, for someone else, and it's only because you don't want to be punished if you do something that's not kind, you know. That's not the proper motivation. You have to do it from the heart. So what you're really describing is not only approach to writing, and I know you run into this all the time, is it's an approach to life. I mean, your book talks about that too. This isn't only about creativity. This is about life as well, and how we choose to act and why.
It's about living creatively, which doesn't mean you're an artist or a writer. It means that you're living those same creator principles, which are really life principles anyhow.
You know, I often talk about the creative community, and you know, the irony of that is we are all the creative community. We are all creators. We are creating our lives. We are creating this world.
In every moment.
Yes.
With every breath.
You know, lately I've been getting you know, people writing to me or asking me about the very premise of this show. It's very common right now, and I think it would be good to enter into a discussion of this, and you may even want to read something else from one of your books, is about fear. Fear is running rampant right now, whether it's, you know, fear of the very big things, like what's going on in the world, and then also fear of the little things, that life is not always smooth right now because of the way the world is shifting, and it's having a very real impact on many of the people listening to this show. We have callers who come in all the time when we have readers on, which I do have on periodically, asking about blockages in their lives and really frightening situations, and how do you transcend that? I mean, I think that both of us probably agree it's very much in the moment. That's what I always tell people, is you can control your reaction in the moment. Even if you failed in the last one and you fail in the next, there is no real failure. It's just, what am I focusing on right now? How am I reacting? But could you speak about fear, Mark David, and fear of even the circumstances of our lives, you know, in this world right now where there can be some challenges on the brink of 2012 as we shift?
Well, first I want to say that I don't know that the human race has ever been without fear. And I think what is stunning right now, perhaps, is that the fear and the causes of fear, and I'm going to get into trouble for this one, the causes and causers of fear are the real terrorists.
Yes.
And, you know, that's not a popular sentiment. However, what's stunning about this time is that the fear and the causes and causers of fear are becoming visible. And I think that is why, well, what was invisible but present is now visible but present. And I think that is what is, in effect, making it even seeming to be more terrifying, because now we're seeing what really has been driving our culture for millennia. And the opportunity is in seeing the fear to find a way through and past it. Unfortunately, I know no other way, and if you know one, please share it with me, of getting past the fear other than going through it. And so if we as a global community, or at least a Western culture, are in a place of what seems like rampant fear, but frankly is no more fearful than it ever was. I think it's just, again, just visible. Then the opportunity now is to feel it, be in it, with it, and get through to the other side of it. Because until now, we've never given ourselves that opportunity. And it's funny because, of course, the show is called Beyond the Frontier of Fear, and I just yesterday changed the subtitle of Act of Surrender, which, of course, may change many more times between now and whenever, if ever, it's published. But the original, well, the most recent title was A Journey Beyond Faith. The title I changed it to yesterday was A Journey to the Other Side of Fear.
Oh, I like that.
They really are saying the same thing, because without the fear, you don't need the faith. So
that's
beyond
true.
Faith is the same place as beyond fear. One of the reasons I changed it was actually strictly a marketing reason. I did not want the book to be confused with a religious book.
It's
a spiritual book, but
right.
I didn't want the word faith to get in people's way of connecting.
You know, I actually labeled this show with faith rather intentionally, I have to say.
Yeah, well, you have a history
in my devious way
that supports that.
Well, I actually wanted to bring those people in, is that I want to speak to a diverse audience, and know that you are. I mean, when the people who
course.
Listen to this show are from many different, but I prod them. I mean, we all do. We're on here. I mean,
my concern was that it would attract the people of faith and not the other ones.
That's probably a very astute observation. And it's funny that you should call it that, because it really is kind of this idea. I mean, why did I call my show The Frontier Beyond Fear? And actually, technically, our books could be similar, because you know that, although not the content, but if I ever get around to writing and finishing, it's not that I haven't written. I mean, I have written for The Frontier Beyond Fear. That is the other book that I've been working on. It's not my top emphasis right now, because I'm working on my Prophetess book, but the whole premise of this radio show and that is the idea. What is a frontier? It is something, it's like a new place to discover. And for me, I feel I feel that we can move into what really does feel like a new frontier, where we're not driven by our fears, because all of history, survival mode of humanity, almost all the things that have driven us, it's been based in fear. And it's really almost like, we are evolving. You know, if you look at animals, they are driven often by fear of one kind. Survival is often, there's that gut instinct. And the idea is again, just as you're saying, moving beyond. And it seems to be the theme that's showing up everywhere. You know, we can't, nobody owns this theme right now because everybody's reaching the same conclusion in their lives. I mean, their lives are writing the books is what's going on, and we're figuring it out. And the more frightening the world becomes, the more we're actually able to transcend it. I have often had people tell me that, oh, you know, I think they assume I've never had adversity. Sometimes when you speak like you do have a lot of faith, I don't know if you've run into this, and I'm going to ask you this question right now. Do you get ever where people wonder, well, you know, have you really ever faced something, you know, challenging, and that it's easy to talk that way when you haven't? And the fascinating thing is I think you don't get to that point often until you have. I mean,
it's well, like I said before, there's no, without, for better or for worse, without fear and doubt and uncertainty, there's no reason to have faith.
Yes.
And so the deepest faith comes, and the deepest trust, and the deepest surrender comes from those, goes to those whose faith is challenged the most profoundly.
How does faith relate to trust in your mind? To me, they are not exactly the same, but they are
no,
related.
They're not. Yeah. So let's see if I can find a way of framing this. I think for me, and again, we're playing semantics, and so this is my interpretation of the words.
Yes.
It may not be somebody else's. It begins with faith, whatever the it happens to be. From faith, it moves to a place of surrender. And then from surrender, it moves to a place of trust, because the trust comes in the act, for me, in the action.
Uh-huh.
So the faith is the unknown. The surrender is the beginning of action, and then the trust is the action, acting from a place where I do trust that whatever's going to happen will be in the highest good. Of course, there is nothing other than the highest good. There is no lowest good, because in the end, whatever we do has an element of highest good built into it. Whatever we do, if we're open to seeing the good in it, then or distilling good from it, however horrifying it may have been,
mm-hmm.
then we have something to move forward with. I'm not sure if that, you know, I'm not sure that's really an answer to your question, but it's the best I could do on short notice.
No, well, it was kind of that's a pretty profound question I asked you. You know, I often. This show is spontaneous, that's for sure. And that doesn't mean that we always have the answers. In fact, when my guests come on here, I don't always, it's an exploration. We are just having a conversation. And, well, the reason I asked that question is I really have been personally exploring this idea of faith versus trust and what does it mean. And I do get, especially lately, because I keep on this other radio show, where I speak on this show, I do get questioned, you know, how can you have so much faith? How can you keep emphasizing the positive? And it's not as if I don't question the negative, and I do. But it has to do with a kind of trust. And one of the things I think is helpful, I have had adversity in my life, and it's true, I haven't gone into it all. And it's because it's a pretty challenging area to go into. And I will say that I wouldn't trade it away if not for those things that occurred. And I'm sure everyone who has had adversity, if you really reflect upon it, you realize that you would never be, I would never be here. I would not be on this show. I would not be speaking. I don't know if I'd be writing. I had actually stopped writing for many years, even though I used to like to write. But if not for those experiences, some of which came across in a very adverse way, I wouldn't be here. And it sounds almost trite to say that, because I've heard people say it so many times, and yet there is a real truth to that. And it does have to do with your higher good. And I think that's why I do tend to think that the law of attraction, when presented on the surface, simplifies life in a way that is not, it just doesn't really reflect my own experience. Because I never realized, but I always wanted to be a writer. Here's a good example. I always wanted to be a writer, Mark David, from as long as I can remember. And yet I kept myself from being a writer for many years. And it was those adverse experiences that not only led me to being a writer and a speaker, but also awakened me. I had no spiritual anchor until I went through some adversity. And so
I think that's true. I think that's true for everyone, and that's why, well, to put it kind of boldly, if you have an event, if something happens to you, you have a choice of seeing the good in it or the bad in it. And we have that choice in every moment. And of course, there is no bad, but you know, the uplifting, or the whatever the opposite of uplifting would be in this context. If you can tell me what the life benefit would be in seeing the negative and living from that place, I'll entertain it. I can't see any. All I can see is that, and maybe I'm being Pollyanna-ish, but all I can see is that by seeing the good, the higher good, the redemptive value of an experience, that allows me to move forward.
Yeah.
By seeing the horror in it, that stops me in my tracks, and there's nowhere to go.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes I think even the horror, as you were saying that, it's funny, I was reflecting even upon world events, and that, you know, there are some danger signs in the world right now that people are surfacing, and it's because they remember the horror of when things go awry. I mean, they haven't allowed that to move out of our memories. I mean, I think some people, and this can be carried to a very dark place, and a lot of people are carrying it there where, you know, we're just, I've heard so many things among different circles, whether evangelical or New Age alike, you know, talking about just some really dark things going on in the world. And it's like, yes, there are dark things going on in the world. But when you have this higher understanding, it's absolutely the only way I can come to terms with the world itself, not just my personal life, but the world and all the things that have brought us here, all the horrors. I mean, you can, I'm studying, I've spent, for a while it was pretty oppressive because I'm studying prophetesses, and I really had to delve into the witchcraft years and what they used to do to witches. And, you know, even the imagery that you can surface is just horrifying. I mean, if you go looking at certain artwork from the Middle Ages and, you know, what motivated these people to be so horrendous to their fellow human beings. And, you know, rather than judge it, I mean, I really do think the core of it is fear. Fear is always it. And then, you know, people say it's so that they could control people. Well, the only reason you want to control someone is because you're afraid of what's going to happen
exactly.
to you if you don't.
Exactly.
And so
exactly.
It's all about fear. And then if you can begin to have some kind of empathy for what allowed people to go down this twisted path. And, you know, ultimately, I think we're led to a path of compassion, and it is through this darkness, you know, I mean, again, cliche, but if you'd never known the darkness, how would you know the light? You wouldn't even be able to recognize it.
Right.
And, you know, why are we here? Why are we here? And why aren't we totally, you know, and it's the hardest question. We've addressed it many times on this show. The most challenging question in the universe is, you know, why do these dark things occur? And people come up with all kinds of explanations. They want to attribute it to a devil or some evil force. But you know, well, then why is that allowed? You know, I mean, you can keep following them.
The why, you know, it's like we're like little kids who keep saying why all the time.
Uh-huh.
And the answer ends up being because. You know,
it is. Yes.
Because it is, you know, and
it is.
There's nothing wrong with exploring the questions and looking for answers. Of course there isn't. But at a certain point, that very human, mind-centered desire to analyze and dissect gets us nowhere. Because that's what we're looking for, is integration and synthesis, not disintegration. I want to read something from the Moon Quest, and it wasn't and it isn't what we had talked about, because I we were talking about going beyond fear. I remembered, I just found it, took me a few minutes, a scene toward the end, toward the end of the book, last third of the book, where Toshar, the main character, falls into a fever and basically goes into a coma where he has a kind of vision. And just to give a little background on the book for those who don't yet know what it's about, it takes place in it's a fantasy. It takes place in a mythical time and place where stories have been banned, storytellers have been put to death, three young people and an older man, led by one of them, Toshar, are on a quest to bring story back to the land and light back to a darkened moon, because in this land, or so the legend goes, the moon was so saddened by the silence that she cried tears and extinguished her light. So the Moon Quest is a quest to bring story back and bring light of the moon back. Anyway, this is, I don't know, about 100 pages from the end, and Toshar has just done something incredibly brave, and this is so true in my life, you know, maybe less now than it used to be, that I would, without thinking, act courageously on my own behalf, and once whatever it was had passed, I'd panic in retrospect. And this is kind of what is happening to Toshar. Wetness touched my lips and dribbled down my chin. Coolness bathed my face. I tried to open my mouth to speak, my eyes to see. They wouldn't obey. What are you saying? I wanted to ask. But I couldn't feel my tongue in my mouth. My mouth. I can't feel my mouth. A flash of panic, and then I feel nothing. Hear nothing. Know nothing. I'm falling, sinking, floating, breathing cool, damp air. Now, no air, no sound, no light. Everything is black, dark, empty. Nothing. And then something. The faintest ripple of air, a light feather touch. It's there, then gone. There again, enfolding me, cushioning me, embracing me. Am I still falling? Everything is so dark, impenetrably dark. Everything? No, nothing. And then something, a distant flicker. It wavers and gutters as it draws closer, grows larger. A hand cups the flame from behind. The light is nearly upon me, dancing atop a yellow taper. No gold, no blue, no red. The colors dance as the flame pirouettes. Now the taper is white as the hair, as the halo of hair behind it, as white as the robe emerging from the shadows. Do you know me, Toshar? A woman's voice issues gently from the flame. Toshar, I know that name from somewhere. Where? Do you know me? The flame repeats, now in a man's voice, equally gentle. You are fire, I say, but who is Toshar? Who is Toshar? The voice is male and female, neither and both. I can't remember. Does it matter? You are Toshar. The hand falls away, and with it the shadow, revealing an ancient face etched with wrinkles. Candle flames dance in eyes as black as the blackness that surrounds us. It's a woman lung, white hair flowing freely over her naked breasts. No, it's a man, his chest buried under a snowy beard. The face is male and female, neither and both. You are Toshar Moonquester. I am Toshar Kolar. We are one, you and I, one at a time. It makes no sense, yet I understand in a way that surpasses understanding. I reach out to touch the apparition, but there's nothing to touch to reach out with. I have no body. What am I whisper. Where am I? You are here and not here, everywhere and nowhere. You are dream, you are reality. You are light, you are dark. This place, too, is all of that, and none of it. I don't understand, I said. You will in time. Why have you summoned me, Moonquester? I summoned you? Forgive me, I forget it was so long ago. What was? This encounter. This marriage of past, present, and future into the eternal now. You confuse me. Do you remember nothing? Nothing of Quintana, nothing of Menor, nothing of Barakin? Memory's door opens a crack. I pull it shut with a cry of pain. Was it truly that bad, he asks, more to himself than to me, as his image begins to dissolve. Where are you going, I cry. If you do not know yourself and me, then do you know me? Holding the candle is a wrinkled crone leaning on a walking stick. Behind her, beyond an archway into a misty, fluttering light, sits a steaming teapot atop a three-legged table. Come, she says. She releases the candle, which hovers in the air unassisted, and extends her hand to me. I see another hand, mine. It takes it and follows her across the threshold. Perhaps some tea will reawaken your self-fullness. Grandmother? Come, she says. Sit on your favorite pillow and drink from your favorite mug. I cup my hand around a familiar piece of clay. Its green chevron shimmers luminously against my skin. I raise the mug and feel the steam bathe my eyes. As the sweet tea touches my lips and slides down my throat, I remember. I remember it all. Oh, grandmother, I'm so frightened. I know, child. Her voice is a cool evening breeze that sweeps away a scorching summer day. But why? Why did I feel no fear then, only to feel it now? I start to tremble. Yulisha refills my mug. Drink this, she says. It will restore the balance. Her eyes never leave me. You understand yet who greeted you when you reached this world between worlds? I shake my head. You will be Eldervart, son of my son. But what you saw was you in the time to come. But she, I mean, he, I mean, that both, I mean, which? Yulisha's smile fails to ease my confusion. He and she explains. A union of all the qualities masculine and feminine resides in the truest of bards. Well, I mean, how? No, she laughs. You will not appear that way to the world no more than do I. Her voice grows serious. Look at me closely. Look at me with the eyes of a bard, with the eyes of Toshar, elder bard to be. I shut my eyes and reopen them. As I stare through the violet of Yulisha's eyes, her face shifts subtly. A masculine jaw, firmer mouth, cheeks sprinkled with salt and pepper stubble of a day's growth. It lasts only an instant, then the familiar features return. There is so little difference, and yet we are one, as will you be when your time comes. She gazes at me, her eyes boring through skin, bone, and blood, and smiles. And come it does. You ask why you fear once the fearful has passed. Yes, grandmother. She lifts her mug and takes a first sip of tea. Know first, child, that you needn't understand everything, that mystery is among life's greatest gifts. Setting her cup on the table, she takes my hand in hers. They are like velour, soft, smooth, warm. You fear your strength. You fear your power. You fear your fearlessness. You fear the future because you cannot see where it will lead. And you fear what you cannot imagine. You have glimpsed what may lie ahead, but you are now only building the foundation of that future. if you continue to build stone by heavy stone, you and that elder bard will meet again. If you continue to follow the path that is yours alone to follow, you will be that sage, the greatest sage in the time of Quintana's greatest king, under the gaze of a grateful moon. If not, then who can say? She gestures to the door. It is time for you to return to your friends. They worry. There is much traveling before you reach the mirror. Much traveling. As I stand, Yulisha's image fades. Wait, I cry. I reach out, but my hand passes through her as through a cloud. What if I fear? I'm still frightened. Only the candle and Yulisha's voice remain. Walk with your fear. Walk through your fear. Walk on into the promise. The candle recedes and darkness returns. Everything is black, dark, empty. Nothing. And then something. Voices, familiar voices. Breathing regularly again. Skin cooler. More water. Raise his head. Hear me? Speak, Toshar, one word. Slowly, black turns gray, turns cloudy, and the mist dissipates. Leaves. A thick curtain of leaves, framing a face, appears anxiously into mine. And then he wakes up, or comes, regains consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really powerful. I feel almost in trance listening It was
the notion, again, of walking with your fear, walking through your fear, walking on and into the promise. And the other, I think, piece that spoke to what we're talking about was the notion of mystery, not having to know what everything means, not having to understand anything other than the fact that some things in this life remain a mystery. And maybe at some point, beyond the veil, we will have the answers, but frankly, I suspect that by the time we get there, we won't care about the answers.
Well, you know, at that point, we may just know, and yes, it just, we'll realize that we created the answers. So,
of course,
the answers won't be separate from us.
Exactly.
And, you know, that is part of this always asking why. There's something very externalizing about that, if you really think about it, that if you really truly believe that we are one, and this comes through in that passage that you read as well, how, you know, acknowledging his oneness
mm-hmm.
with the Elder Bard, and taking that to the highest level, if you do acknowledge your oneness with God, Source, Spirit, or whatever you choose to call the creative force in the universe, there can be no why in that, because the whys are all known.
Well, and
at some level of you.
The why demonstrates the lack of faith.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's natural on the human path to want to figure it out. And I will tell you, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think perhaps the wisest thing I have come to learn through my years on both, well, they've all been on a path, they haven't always been consciously on a path, is that I will probably never lose the fact that I want to know. What I try to let go of is the need to know.
I think that if we ever lost touch with the feeling of wanting to discover more,
mm-hmm.
that would diminish the experience. I do feel that way. I think that it is a part of the experience, but I really like that you make that distinction between wanting and needing. Do you have
to know? I don't need to know to keep moving forward. Boy, would I like to.
Yeah.
And things are revealed. But even those things that are revealed in our very human longing to know are only, again, a piece of that iceberg. So even when you think you get an answer, it's never the complete answer, because it can't possibly be.
You know, so often those of us on the spiritual path, you know, when we put ourselves out there, I will get questions. In fact, I've even I've had discussions with atheists and agnostics, and some of them can be rather hostile. Not all. I mean, these are thoughtful people. I have no judgment of someone on that path, and I actually understand. Although I never really walked that path, I've been an agnostic as to the nature of God and what I would choose to define as God. And in that sense, I definitely understand. But the thing is that the part of this that's important is when you're on the spiritual path, often people will ask you why. They'll ask you to explain it. And if you can't explain it, there's an implied judgment in that. And I'm not saying that we should internalize those judgments, but it's unsatisfactory to them when you say, this is an area of faith. This is a place where I simply believe this is where we're heading, and I've seen certain evidence that I can't necessarily convey to you. Look for your own evidence. You know, if you ask for some evidence to help you on your path, if that's what you need, I certainly encountered some on my path having to do with reincarnation. It helped me. It helped me get beyond some limitations I had. It's out there. But do I have all the answers that I can explain to you? Do I have to defend my faith? I guess that's the thing. And the answer is no. This is a personal experience. Every person's journey, wherever it takes, if your journey in this life is to be pretty much devoid of an obvious spiritual path, I'm sure much of my life was like I actually ran from all forms of spirituality for many years. Well, because I was terrified. I mean, when you talk about facing your fears, my greatest fear was that I doubted. When I was young, you know, who was this girl who wrote in a journal after coming from church, what if God is an imposter? And I hadn't read what's that series, the children's book, where it's all about that. You know, I hadn't read anything about that yet. That was my own conclusion. Because I was reading things that didn't add up, that didn't make sense to me. And eventually I ran from hell. And it was only by facing hell. I actually faced hell in a very direct way. I mean, not a literal way, because hell doesn't exist in a literal sense, but in terms of, and even just giving a little hint of my journey, I make it akin to a vision quest. In fact, I often think this is why people have had vision quests. It's one of the tools, and not one to be taken lightly, because one of the things that happens when you venture into the higher visionary realms is what's there with you, like Luke going into the cave with in one of the Star Wars movies, your fears. And you're going to end up facing those fears. And before you can get through, and not everybody has to take this walk. It's a very challenging walk to go there. But for me, it's the only reason I can now very decisively speak the way I do, because I faced that fear. And if I hadn't, I never would have had a spiritual life. In fact, I wouldn't be speaking. Forget that. I really wouldn't be living in a way that to me is much more fulfilling. I'd be living some kind of life, but it would be more of a surface life without that spiritual anchor. And I think often it's the crisis that helps us find the path, and that's mm-hmm. what happened to me. So but I totally am on the same page with respect to you must walk with your fear. And, you know, I still have some. I wish I could say I was beyond every possible fear. Oh, no. I mean, I told you before this show, I had kind of a not the greatest week. In fact, I was even thinking, great, you know, I'm going to go on this show with Mark David Garrison. He's so, you're so, or Gerson, I always say your last name wrong. He's so inspirational. And you know, I really wasn't feeling all that inspired yesterday. yesterday a little bit more, but during the week, you know, I had some things I had to deal with this week, and it was a kind of an emotional week. And, you know, I didn't think I necessarily reacted in a good way to everything. But do I choose to judge myself? No. You know, I can sometimes, yeah, sometimes I do. But if I really am mindful, where do I want to be with my week? Well, you know, honestly, I want to be in this moment. And, you know, whatever baggage I had to deal with this week, I kind of put behind me. And,
yeah.
And yes, we're having a great conversation because we're in this moment. And, you know, there are still things in the world that are terrifying. I mean, that's probably the biggest thing that I think is weighing on a lot of people right now. There are terrifying things in the world right now. I mean, from watching.
Do you choose to be terrorized? Yes. Well, I mean, do you choose to be paralyzed?
Or terrorized is what I was thinking. Yeah, and paralyzed.
Right, but I mean, but then. If you choose to be paralyzed, that means there is no, I mean, my story is, yes, I still feel fear. The difference between the fear I feel now and the fear I felt 20 years ago was the fear I felt 20 years ago stopped me in my tracks.
Mm-hmm.
It did paralyze me.
Yeah.
Not completely, or I could never have made the leap to where I am now, but it certainly paralyzed me enough that the whatever forward motion there was entirely unconscious, and almost in spite of myself, not because of. So yes, and the whole war on terror is all about paralysis. It's all about fear. It's all about forcing you to not move in any direction because you're too scared of what might happen.
Well, and you know, and it's not even just that. I mean, there really are some. I mean, I guess it's just on so many levels, from the climate change, from things that the news has become more blatantly in my lifetime than I recall. It's not really reporting things. Like, things just disappear. Like, whatever happened to that nuclear power plant in Japan, you know, it's still spewing stuff, yet it's hardly in the news. And we're not really hearing. I mean, you could be afraid of so many things. And then, you know, like the pepper spraying incidents, looking
right
at those, and that's just chilling, what you see there.
But here's the difference.
But
here's
there's a triumph there as well. There's courage there that I see.
We get to see it.
Yes.
I mean, the media is so all-pervasive, for better or for worse, and in some cases for better, in this case for better, that it's, you know, even in totalitarian countries, because of smartphones and social media, you can't terrorize your population without people knowing about it.
Yeah. Well, I think the most
and so
scary
all
thing.
All this stuff was happening before, going back to what I said before, early in the show.
Yeah.
Now we see it. And now because we see it, we have an opportunity to act.
And, you know, we're reacting differently. Why did, you know, I was pondering this recently, just like the example of that pepper spray incident. Why was it replayed over and over? The compelling thing was not just the way control was inappropriately asserted, but it's the reaction of the people who are sitting there. It's the courage and the grace that they are exhibiting. And this is true in all the other countries. And, you know, I think probably the most terrifying thing, if you choose, I use the word terrifying somewhat figuratively because I'm choosing not to be terrorized by this.
Yes.
But I think probably the most challenging things people are dealing with right now is looking in the mirror of our own land and seeing the reflection of those places that we have called totalitarian, where we have called oppressive, and we're seeing in the actions that are beginning to occur in our own country things that we would highly criticize in other places. You know, in fact, there's even an irony where certain things are happening here that we actually have very strongly as a nation criticized in other countries, and yet I think there's nothing more challenging than looking in the mirror and having to see the true reflection. And like you said, it's being surfaced. And, you know, beyond that reflection is the truer reflection is that we are not that darkness either. I mean, see, that's what I see, is we see the light too, and we see it coming forth. And here and in other lands, it's happening worldwide. Where there's nothing that can be done to stop it, because it really is. I have never in my life felt this dichotomy, if I allow it, to be afraid, but also of such amazing hope. I mean, I have never seen mass consciousness in action like I have in the last year, and it is a truly amazing thing to see in the world.
Absolutely. And again, what was hidden is now being revealed. And because it's being revealed, sometimes in inappropriate ways, absolutely, but because it's being revealed, we have an opportunity to make choices. Because what has been in the dark is now in the light. Doesn't mean what's happening is light-filled, but what's happening is now bathed in enough light that we can see what's going on.
And I think that very light is transforming the tools that we now have at our disposal to shift those things that are occurring that are dark. We're not stuck in the conventional world anymore. You know, we're not going to recreate this horrible, I mean, really, if we were going to go down the path that often humanity has, we would end our time here, at least for this particular civilization. And we're not going there. I mean, I think enough of us know, and there is a magical aspect to it. I think often, you know, when you get really into the conspiracy stuff and all that, people get really depressed, and they somehow lose sight, even when they believe in it, that there really are miracles. There really is a magical element to the world. I think we're actually living in any number of visionary novels, including yours. And if we could only realize that is not just some visionary fantasy, Mark David, and you know that too. And I don't even mean just symbolic. I mean, okay, the particular story is a particular story. There be magic in this world, and we've seen it. Many of us have seen it firsthand, and we haven't imagined it. We've seen it together, and that is going to take us to the next level.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, we are kind of nearing the end of our time together, although I will tell you something really cool about Blog Talk Radio that I've learned recently is that there is no abrupt end anymore. For the archive, which is where we get probably the majority of listeners, you can actually go over a minute or two and you don't get cut off anymore, which I love. Because
In that case, let me read something which is kind of memoir-like from the Voice of the Muse.
Take your time, because we do have time. The only thing I'll say to the audience, anyone listening live, the only way to hear the show once we go back past 12:30 Pacific is to call in, actually, 310-807-5104, and just sit on the line and listen if you want to hear it live, or just wait a few minutes and it'll be in the archive. You know, whenever we're done. But yeah, go right ahead, Mark David, and don't feel pressured by an abrupt cutoff time.
Okay. This is called, ironically, I didn't have the title of my, or any notion of the memoir at the time. This little chapter is called Surrender to the Journey. In June 1997, I embarked on an odyssey whose consequences I could never have predicted or imagined. I'd been living back in Toronto for only a short while when a voice in my heart urged me to pack all I owned, not a lot, into the back of my Dodge Caravan and head west. At other times in my life, I would have doubted the message, question my sanity. On that sunny morning, I knew my only choice was to trust and follow my heart. For 3 months, I journeyed. I traveled north and west from Toronto along the rugged forested shores of Lake Huron and Lake Superior, then south and west, crossing Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, and Oregon. From the Oregon coast, I slipped south into California, then shot back east across Nevada and Utah before dropping into northern Arizona. Throughout those months, I never planned my next stop. When I tried, my plans were nearly always thwarted by some seemingly outside force. Mostly, I let my heart control the steering wheel, and I followed wherever it took me. It was a magically transformative experience, though not without stress, for it was difficult at times to surrender fully. Part of me longed to plot out an itinerary, to know where I would drive the next week, to know where I would end up. The greater, more courageous part of me trusted in the infinite wisdom of the journey. Through all the unexpected stops, unanticipated detours, and unpredicted forays into uncharted territory, all I could do was trust in each moment and believe that the story I was living would reveal itself through the living of it. It did, magnificently. On the morning of the full moon in September, after 90 days of journeying, I drove into Sedona, Arizona. I expected this to be another whistle stop on the road to wherever. Instead, 1 week grew to two, 1 month to seven. Before I knew it, I had a new country, a new wife, and a new baby on the way. Had I given my brain mind the control it sought, might never have left Toronto, might never have launched a journey that gifted me with so much richness. Part of what prepared me for this odyssey was the Moon Quest, the novel whose early drafts I had already written, much as I had lived that journey, moment by moment and word by word, ignorant of the outcome, but trusting that one would emerge. When we surrender to our heart mind, trusting that the outcome will be more wondrous than anything we could consciously imagine, it always is. As you write, let your pen carry you as my Dodge Caravan did me, in trust and surrender. Let it carry you to the story you didn't know. Let it carry you to the story you didn't know you knew, as breath by breath, you move toward an outcome that is yet to reveal itself. And I'm going to follow that by, I didn't plan to do this, but there's the very end of the book. At the end of the book, I talk about, because a lot of this book was written in Sedona, I talk about how, from Sedona, my family and I moved to Hawaii. We came back to Sedona, and how wonderful it was to be back in Sedona. And the book actually ends with this. The next chapter of my life didn't play out as I expected when writing the previous piece. 2 years later, my marriage ended, and I again found myself on the sort of open-ended road trip I wrote about in Surrender to the Journey. This time, my journey from Sedona, not to it, took me across the continent not once but multiple times on a voyage that lasted 30 months, not three. This time, I landed not among the red rocks of northern Arizona, but on the high desert slopes of Albuquerque Sandia Mountains. Yet in most other ways, the parallel with my 1997 odyssey is complete. Like all of us, I am in the midst of a story that is still being written, whose ending has yet to be revealed. Mm-hmm. As I move into the next chapter of my life here in New Mexico, and again, this was written several years ago, I'm reminded that this, like all journeys, is one of infinite surrender, word by word, moment by moment, breath by breath. I'm particularly reminded of this as I reflect on where I wrote the first draft of this particular chapter, in Santa Fe, a city whose name translates as holy faith. Uh-huh. In this moment, I cannot tell you how this chapter will end, nor where the next will take me, just as I cannot yet know where the Moon Quest sequel, the Star Quest, will go as it returns to its pages. All I can do, all we can ever do in writing as in life, is trust in the story. It has never let me down, truly. The story knows best.
You know, that is so, so true. Can we all just trust in our own stories? Because And can we realize how our stories intertwine with everyone else's?
Exactly.
And in fact, I keep thinking at the end of Mitch Albom's book, there's that, the five people you meet in heaven, I believe. Actually, I get them, it's hard to, when we've seen these things dramatized, you see, I'm thinking of the movie, the TV movie that was made, and I can't remember the exact words at the end of the book, but I remember what was in the movie is, you know, the world is full of stories, and the stories are all one.
Yes, beautiful.
And that is so key. And yet, you know, and the, can we value the individual story, which is why we're here? I mean, your story mm-hmm. and my story, it's the reason we're here. And can we value that and also reflect upon the beauty of the oneness as well? I think that is so very key and very, very profound words, Mark David. You, I think, I know you have been revealing your memoir a little at a time in pieces in your blog. And in fact, one of the things we haven't done is I want to make sure people know where to find you and your writing. So why don't you let people know those things? Because I know people would like to learn more about you.
Sure, this is probably a great place to end, because I actually have to go back to writing. But,
so do I. I think we both have things that we will be going to. So
go ahead and
let people know where your website is, and I will put it in the show notes as well. But go right ahead.
Sure. So the best way to reach me and find out all the other ways to reach me is on my website, which is Mark David Gerson, all one word, Mark with a K, Gerson, GERSON.com. The Acts of Surrender excerpts that Susan was speaking about are on my blog, which is MarkDavidGersonBlog.com. I will add, though, that just going back to what I said earlier, that those are not direct excerpts, because as I'm discovering, those pieces are also kind of teaching pieces, and that's not the form that the book is taking, but they are powerful pieces nonetheless. You can contact me directly through my website. You can also find me on Facebook, and I'd love that you sent me a friend request at my username on Facebook and on Twitter are both Mark David Gerson. I'm also on Google+, and you can find a link to that on my website as well. If you want to see a great, I think, so I'm told, visual meditation, supposedly for writers, but really is for anyone who is creative or living a creative life, it's called You Are a Writer. You'll find it and some other inspiring videos on my YouTube page, which is youtube.com/, once again, Mark David Gerson. And the books are The Moon Quest, A True Fantasy, which is book one in the Quintana Trilogy. That's the only one that is out yet. The other book is called The Voice of the Muse, Answering the Call to Write, and there's also a CD companion called, strangely enough, The Voice of the Muse Companion, Guided Meditations for Writers. Both books and the CD are available on my website. Both books and the CD are available on Amazon. The two books, not the CD, are available at BarnesandNoble.com, and both and e-book versions of both books are available in all the major formats, Kindle, Nook, iBook, and Kobo. And you can also find, more recently, an MP3 download of the CD on CD Baby, or more directly, if you go to the, what is it called? Hang on. It's called the, where is this? If you go to the Voice of the Muse page on Facebook, it's facebook.com/call to write, you'll see a link to Music Store, and you can actually download the MP3 directly from the Facebook page, which I think is way cool. And I could go on and on, but there are Facebook pages for the Moon Quest as well and all that, but I think you'll find everything, links to everything really on my website, which once again is markdavidgerson.com.
And knowing that this audience is built on synchronicity, it seems, which actually life seems to be filled with synchronicity now.
Indeed.
I also want to emphasize, if there's anyone listening out there who has an interest in the Quintana Trilogy project, the film project.
Oh, I didn't even mention that. Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah. Why don't you speak to that a little bit?
Sure.
Because you really
okay.
never know who's listening to this show. It's again, there be magic in the world. I remind us
there
of
be,
this.
There be, indeed,
and...
yes. So the Quintana Trilogy is made up of the Moon Quest, the Star Quest, and the Sun Quest. That's both the books and the films. The trilogy is now in the development phase, which is kind of the phase that happens before pre-production. It goes development, pre-production, production. So we're basically trying to line up some cast members and line up more financing. There was actually a website for the trilogy, which is Quintana Movies. Odd spelling, Q-N, no U, Q-N, T as in Tom, A, N as in Nancy, A, QuintanaMovies.com. There's more information on all three stories. There's a little bit of information on the movies also on the website, my website, rather. What's most exciting, I think, for me right now, apart from the fact of it, is that we have only just recently decided that the... instead of shooting one film, waiting, shooting another film, waiting, and then doing the three like over 5 or 6 years, we are now in the midst of shifting all that and rebudgeting so that we can shoot the movies back to back, kind of like the way Lord of the Rings was shot.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's the model of the Lord of the Rings, as I recall.
That's right. That's right. These are a little different because Lord of the Rings is one big story broken up into three. With all the same characters, and although there is carryover in some of the characters, there isn't carryover in all the characters. And for example, the main character of the Moon Quest is never seen again except as an old man in the subsequent movies or subsequent stories. So that's very exciting, and that kind of changes our focus somewhat. There last year, as some of you may know, because we think we talked this on the show last time, or earlier this year, rather, I guess it was, we filmed a teaser to help get some excitement around the movie, and that you can see that on the Quintana Movies website on the homepage. There's also something that I'm really pleased about and proud of. There's a book trailer now for the Moon Quest. And if you go to the main Moon Quest page on my website, or just go to themoonquest.com, you can see that. And that was an amazing piece of synchronicity that just showed up for me, getting that trailer made for me professionally at no cost. And that was just an amazing miracle.
Yeah, so, see, there's an example of how things can come to us. In that happening, that then is assisting all the people who are now... it's a co-creation. I love that. It's a co-creation because it's not only of assistance to you, but it's, of course, opening the door to all the people who will now find that book because of it and the message that it shares. So, I think, I'm really excited to see where all of this takes you, Mark David, because
no one more so than me, actually.
You know, it's always going to be that one of those I knew him when kind of things, and you know, I love how, you know, quite some time ago I just kind of came across you, and you know, it's led to so many great things. I mean, including the artist, I want to mention that, the beautiful artwork for not only your book, and this artist, Richard Crooks, is doing the artwork for my book, but the movie posters associated with the Quintana Trilogy are absolutely breathtaking. This is through the talent of Richard Crooks, who is an amazing artist.
Who I also found through some weird synchronicity here on Facebook.
Well, I called him because I couldn't stop looking at the book cover of The Voice of the Muse. I mean, I just... And people are now saying the same thing although the Prophetess Legacy is not out yet. And actually, I should give him some credit. The Frontier Beyond Fear artwork is by Richard Crooks as well,
because it's correct.
The artwork that's going to go on my book, but it's being used for the overall theme of surrounding the book, including this show. And there is something almost mesmerizing about this artwork, and it carries an energy all its own that is all part of the energy of the project. And, you know, it just goes to show that these projects, whether they're books or movies, they attract people to them because of the overall energy of what's going on. And I know you've already had some very talented cast members who are in that teaser, and you can see the level of professionalism that went into that. And, you know, I just watched it again this morning. I've watched it a few times, the teaser for your films. And there is an energy here, and you can feel them and feel the energy in your words, you know, that you were able to share with us today from the Moon Quest as well. So anyway, I guess, even though, you know, I tell you, this new Blog Talk Radio feature is tempting because it just lets you go on and on. Because we do, well, not forever. It does have a cutoff, but not for a while. I guess we had better get on with all the energy of the projects in our lives that are going on right now. I want to thank you from the heart for what I knew was, and indeed did turn out to be, a very authentic, spontaneous sharing of an honest journey and the wisdom therein.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you in any form.
Well, thank you so much. And and I would certainly welcome you on again in the future sometime, I'm sure. It's always interesting to catch up with what's going on in your life, and who knows what'll be happening then. It just keeps getting more interesting.
And who knows what will happen tomorrow. That's the whole trusting in the story and living in the moment that we were talking about.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Mark David, and I'm gonna just a note to the audience. We have a number of guests coming up on this show. And next week, on the same time slot, we're going to have Robert Hayward, who wrote this book called The 13th Step, One Man's Odyssey of Recovery. And what it is a discussion of how Native American spirituality helped him overcome the ravages of alcoholism. And so it's called The 13th Step. And I'm very gratified by what is an amazing group of guests that are showing up for this show. I have some really amazing things coming up. We've got Robert in a week, and then also a week from next Tuesday, a special holiday return appearance from the angel lady, Sue Storm, is coming for an evening show. So keep an eye on the Frontier Beyond Fear schedule on Blog Talk Radio. I'm also in the process of finally enhancing the frontierbeyondfear.com webpage, so that's frontierbeyondfear.com. And I can be reached if you would like to suggest a guest for this show or have any questions at all. Feel free to send an email to info@frontierbeyondfear.com. And we have a fledgling Facebook community, and I really would welcome people to join that as well and even share your insights there about moving beyond fear. And you can find that. There's a link on the show page, but you can also find it on Facebook if you just search for The Frontier Beyond Fear. So with that said, I want to thank all of you, including once again Mark David, and may you all have a peaceful weekend as we're moving towards the holiday season. May you more and more experience those moments where you are living on that frontier, that place that Mark David would also describe as beyond fear. Thank you all. Mm-hmm.